for me to introduce our closing speaker, Andy Barker, professor and chair of computer science at UMass Amherst, where he runs the lab, which is the birthplace, really, of the field of modern reinforcement learning, the field that we're here to celebrate. And also, in fact, continues to be the lab where many of the great contributions of reinforcement learning come from. To echo something that Peter said in his talk, over the last 20 years that I've been involved in reinforcement learning, since I joined Andy's group, a number of people have remarked on how friendly and open and welcoming this field has been. And I think, like Peter, I think the credit for this does go to the two leaders of the field that bookend this workshop, Rich Sutton and Andy Barker. And in particular, I think the scholarly nature of this field comes from Andy, where, you know, one of the things I learned as a grad student from Andy is nothing pleases him more than finding some obscure book, out-of-print book, some field, yellowed pages where there's some connection to something that we do today, and you know, gets all excited about those sorts of things. And you know, another little tidbit from Andy. I know we're running short of time. I can say a lot more about Andy, but one quick thing. You know, Andy's made contributions. I mean, this is a multidisciplinary symposium, and a number of us here have been doing multidisciplinary work. But you know, Andy's made contributions from neuroscience, psychology, animal learning, to economics, adaptive control, operational research. All of these intersections with reinforcement learning. But one interesting aspect of that is that as soon as the field has more than a handful of people working in it, I think Andy feels it's time to move on and do something new and different. And I think today
I'm not mirroring quite
a bit like that. Something that's sort of new and only a small number of people are working in it. But I think and I hope many of us will be working in that soon. So with that, let's welcome Andy.
I didn't hear any of that. I'm sorry. So, well, I have no idea either. So, I'm delighted to be here. I thank Rich and Dawina and Elliot. Is Elliot here? Yeah. And Satinder. I think I owe everything to my students. I mean, why I'm here is because, I mean, not only because they made me come and do this talk, but, I mean, throughout my whole career, I think I've spent most of my time trying to figure out what my students were doing. And, you know, Rich would come up with these ideas and say, what is that? You know, what does this relate to? And I have no idea. Even my students are actually essential in helping me use computers, as you can see. As you can see here. I give talks all the time. I don't normally have this problem. That's a hidden slide, by the way. That's supposed to be a hidden. Yeah, this is not right.
Not the right talk or not the right place?
What's the name of it?
It's not the right slide. So.
What's the title?
See, those are hidden slides. You're revealing all of my. Well, all right. So let me begin.
Well.
It's. Let me just see what.
You should be good now.
Okay. All right. Now, what was I going to say? Thanks. A lot of great talks. It's a hard axe to follow, and we'll.
We're recording. Can you stay on
that? I have to stay over here. Okay. All right. So. Where was I? So in thinking about this, I was trying to think back to when I felt reasonably knowledgeable about reinforcement learning in terms of having a comprehensive view of of everything that was going on. And I think I was doing pretty well until Dimitri and John's book came out, which took things into another level. And then then we did our book, and I was reasonably okay. And I was doing fine, and then until the surge occurred, which I think of as the Florham Park collection of people at AT&T, were Rich and Michael Littman and Satinder, and there was this great increase in mathematical sophistication. And so my tendency, the way I react to these things is to go off in an orthogonal direction that no one else is working on. And in fact, that's sort of how I got into reinforcement learning in the first place. And so I've started going off again to look at the question of where does the reward come from? And you know, we know that the framework that we've been dealing with is very powerful. One reason it is because it abstracts away from where rewards come from. It's agnostic. You get numbers, you get these R's, and the system will try to maximize the cumulative sum of those no matter where they come from, which is really good. But we know, and I think especially from what Andrew Ng illustrated in his talk, that in applications, it's non-trivial to come up with reward functions. And so I call this beyond RL because we're really moving outside of that RL box to look at this other process of where rewards, primary rewards, come from. So that's what I want to talk about. But Rich had asked us to do a little bit of history, and let me tell you a little bit about my background. So I did my PhD at the University of Michigan. And actually, I say this because a few weeks ago, someone asked me how I got involved in reinforcement learning, and my answer surprised them. And it may surprise you, too. So I was there. John Holland, who is the originator of genetic algorithms, was there and was a hotbed of activity. My advisor was not John, but a student of John's who was doing something else, which I pursued. I never really bought the genetic algorithm story as an optimization algorithm, but I was fascinated by it from a biological point of view and also for the kind of creativity that an optimization process can produce. But I studied system theory and the relationship between state space and frequency domain representations of linear systems. Ended up doing a thesis on cellular automata, which was another area that lots of people there were studying back in those days. In general, I was fascinated by how simple local rules can generate complex global behavior. So just looking at dynamic systems has that character. You have a transition function, and it spins out complicated behavior. Cellular automata go further because there's a structural modularity that underlies what people were calling self-organizing systems, neural networks, evolution, learning. These were the things that I was interested in. I still am. I'm still interested in the idea of local rules generating global behavior. And I was very much influenced by the genetic algorithm idea. Holland was always talking about exploration versus exploitation and so on. And I wanted to, I don't know when this came along, but I wanted to do something like a genetic algorithm with a neural network. I didn't like having a population. I wanted to do it differently. And neural networks were not things that were really heavily studied back then. In the aftermath of Minsky and Papert talking about perceptrons. So I don't know if anybody remembers this picture from Cajon, if you're that old. So this was something that came out, and we thought, wow, this is really interesting. This is an auto-associative memory network. It's basically a correlation matrix, and it's a supervised system in the sense that these four faces were just vectors, and the outer products were formed and summed together to form this matrix. And then Cajonan showed that you could retrieve based on a fragment or a noisy version, and lo and behold, you know, the original face would come out. So this was distributed information storage, and we thought this was pretty cool, but it's a supervised system in the sense that the desired output is provided to the system. And I was interested in systems that could, like a genetic algorithm or any optimization procedure, could discover something. And this, to me, didn't seem like it was discovering anything. Then another thing that I stumbled upon, and I don't remember how or when exactly, was a system called Allopex. Has anyone see this before? Peter, do you know this one? So this stands for Algorithm of Pattern Extraction, a correlation-based learning algorithm first proposed by Tsunaku and Harth. Harth was a physicist at Syracuse University, I believe, retired now. And so this was a time people were investigating the properties of neurons in the visual cortex. And he was interested in frogs, where people would move various objects in front of the animal to see how the neuron responded. And Eric thought that biased things by our perception of what we thought the cells would respond to. So he came up with this idea where a TV would be placed in front of the animal, and each pixel would be an independent reinforcement learning system. And the reward was coming from changes in the firing activity of the cortical neuron. So the idea was that this picture would converge under the influence of the reward provided by the cortical neuron's activity to the favorite image, the image that was most highly preferred by that, that would most highly excite that neuron. And so, and this is a reinforcement learning system. It didn't work very well. It's a very high-dimensional space, and each pixel is working independently. It's like a team of independent reinforcement learning agents. But the idea was very cool. And so I was interested in combining the associative memory idea and this idea. Now, I don't know if this was our first paper, Rich. We may have. I don't remember. But in 81, Rich and Peter Brower, who was a grad student, we published this paper in Biological Cybernetics called Associative Search Network, a Reinforcement Learning Associative Memory. And it was basically Allopex plus Kahonen. And it looked like this. So we had what we called the Associative Search Net, or ASN, connected to an environment. The action was a pattern. So we had a vector action. The input was a vector. And then there was a payoff. Z, we call it. Now we call it a reward, R. And the input vectors were randomly chosen from a set. So it wasn't a MDP. The vectors just occurred uniformly at random. And then the network would generate an output, which would be evaluated. The evaluation, I don't know what's going on with. Let me see if I can fix that. There we go. I have no idea why that happens. But so we added noise to the output of each of these neuron-like units was a weighted sum plus noise threshold. So it was a stochastic, and that was the generate variety in the which was similar to what Harth had done. And then the update rule was basically the Allopex algorithm, which was basically looking at changes in the output of a unit multiplied by changes in the next changes in the evaluation, the Z, and then multiply it by the input. And so it's really delta Z, delta Y times X. And this is basically the Allopex rule, doing a correlation between activity of that unit and the consequential, assuming it takes one time step for that to influence the reward, would do this correlation. Then we found we had some problems because when the context vector changed, the reward might go up or down, not by virtue of something the network did, but by the fact that the input, the situation was different now. And so we added a predictor, which whose when a new context occurred, it would predict the expected level of reward, and then we could compare the actual reward with that. And so we substituted this prediction for the previous Z and updated that just as a one-step ahead LMS predictor. So this was the associative search network. One thing to point out that I think is still interesting is that the payoff is broadcast to all of these units. Okay? And if it were if the learning rule were a Hebbian rule, which is what Kahonen was using, that is if it did not have this response contingency, then all the units would be learning the same thing because they were getting the same instruction signal. But here, since the units are stochastic in their activity, and that activity is used as part of the learning rule, this would really search for patterns that would increase the level of payoff. So this idea of broadcasting, and this is really a team. It's like a multi-agent reinforcement learning system. It's a team. They all have the same payoff, but they don't know the other units exist. So they're just working in their own little noisy environment. But this would converge in simple cases. This was in the days when we didn't have to prove anything. Those good old days. And you can't see this very well, but these were certain context vectors. And I don't think these are linearly independent. These were the output vectors that would patterns that would maximize the payoff. And this shows the payoff increasing over time. This showed then a new unseen context vector that was a combination of previous ones, and it would start very high even in a new circumstance because it's generalizing from those. So we were marrying the ideas of search optimization with this associative memory. There was no control here, but that was kind of the next step. Before getting on, let me mention, I remember going out on the road a lot in those days, and I was a postdoc at University of Massachusetts, and explaining to people this and trying to explain that, you know, this is not supervised learning. This is trial and error learning. And even this is a quote from Bernie Widrow, the originator of the LMS supervised learning rule, and he was confused about this. This is a quote: "The boss continually seeks a better worker by trial and error experimentation with the structure of the worker. Adaptation is a multidimensional performance feedback process. The error signal in the feedback control sense is the gradient of the mean square error with respect to adjustment." So he was talking about LMS, which is getting assigned error as if it were trial and error learning. And that's just really not distinguishing between supervised learning and reinforcement learning. So it took us a while to convince people that this was a different sort of learning. Most people were studying supervised learning neural networks back in those. We were not the first to do reinforcement. Minsky's thesis involved reinforcement learning. Turing talks about it. It goes way back. But in these days, people had, you know, I guess the perceptron was clearly supervised. LMS was supervised, and people were fascinated by the generalization capabilities of these things and sort of lost this other dimension of the active search. Okay, and then at a certain point, here's this infamous pole balancing paper that we did, but it was clear that the evaluator didn't even need to see the output. All it needed to see was some distal consequence of the output, and it could evaluate that. And the system could still learn to improve performance with regard to that. So that leads to control. And so this was a degenerate kind of associative search network. We called it an associative search element. And meanwhile, Rich had been working on a predictor, namely what became the temporal difference algorithm that showed up here as the adaptive critic element. And so we did this. So one of the grad students said it would be really cool if you could balance a pole, learn to balance a pole with this. So we thought we'd try it. So, as an interesting story, our paper, 83 or something, has an error in it. Peter knows this error, but the sign of gravity is wrong in the equation. So now we simulated the right thing, but I won't say who wrote that part of the paper, but the sign is wrong. So I got I don't know if there was email in those days or not, but I got a message from someone saying, my algorithm learned to balance this in one trial. And I said, I know exactly what you did. So anyway, a lot of mileage out of that. But the idea that the evaluator doesn't need even to see the response of these adaptive units, just needs to see consequences of them. And then we moved on, or at least I did. I was looking at layered networks and broadcasting a reward signal, and you could get the right kind of learning rule to learn nonlinear mappings in the same way. The evaluation signal can be broadcast to the whole net. And this was before backprop. And backprop came out and was much faster because my networks were stochastically estimating the gradient in this kind of team fashion, and backprop computes it. So it was eclipsed by backprop, but I think, you know, has more plausibility from a biological point of view. Anyway, so that's all very ancient history, and it leads me to say that for me, the essence of RL, and this is different from Rich. Rich and I don't agree on too much. We agree on a lot, but not everything. For me, and you can see from my history, that I think of RL as search and memory. Not really search, optimization, I think. I mean, search is misleading because there's different one kind of search is when you know what you're looking for, and when you get it, you recognize it, and you stop searching. I'm talking about extremizing something, and you don't know when you're there, so it's an incessant activity, which is what is appealing to me about these kinds of systems. So, but it's not just search alone, but it's memory. So the idea is that you remember what worked best, and then in the next time you're in a similar situation, you start from where you left off. So caching search results, to me, is the essence of reinforcement learning. So it's a bit of a different take, but Rich and I fit very well together because prediction is an essential part of doing this when you get into more complicated problems. So beyond RL. Okay, so that's the topic of... have I talked for half an hour already?
No.
Okay. Can I talk as long as I want? I'm the last speaker. I don't want to keep people from dinner or airplanes. So here's a usual view. We actually saw this yesterday. I think Jerry used this. I think Leslie Kaebling drew this initially or created this picture. So here's an agent interacting with an environment, getting state and reward and action. And this is sort of the usual view. And it's extremely misleading. Extremely misleading. Rich contributed to this misleading view just the other day. Here's a less misleading view. So this is focusing in on that robot. And we say this in our book. We say don't confuse the reinforcement learning agent with a robot or an organism. You know, it's a more abstract thing. And if you do think of a robot or an organism, it's inside, and the reward comes from inside. We don't have sense organs for reward. The brain generates these. Actually, Wolfram's Scholarpedia articles distinguish. There's a Scholarpedia article on reward, and then there's another one on reward signals. And so the reward is an object in the world that we like. And so what I'm talking about are reward signals in his terms, because those are coming from inside the agent. And then they're internal sensations, blood sugar level, all sorts of things like that, and a robot battery level, other things. Memory. current value function, current policy, and so on, can all be part of the state. And then, of course, external sensations as well. And some people would argue that there's more than one RL agent in an organism, that are in a multi-agent kind of system, dealing with different aspects of the organism's machinery. So I think of this, for want of a better label, as a motivational system. And I wouldn't claim seriously that it maps on to everything that's involved in motivation, but as a source of rewards and as a source of internal state, it fits reasonably well with how psychologists think of motivational systems. And so when we look at motivation, the sort of classical view is that involves forces that direct the activity of an organism. And sort of in physics envy language, which is really what characterized this definition, psychologists distinguish between extrinsic motivation, being moved to do something because of some external reward, like our R that we usually think of with regard to reinforcement learning, and then intrinsic motivation, being moved to do something because it's inherently enjoyable, just for the sake, for its own sake. And that things like curiosity, exploration, manipulation, play, perhaps learning itself, is rewarding and creates intrinsic motivation. So how do we make intrinsically motivated agents? And what does this even mean? So this is important. I think it was yesterday. Let's see. We were hearing about the contest. And one of the entries did well because when it got a 0, it changed to a 1. Okay, so this, you know, we don't want to do that. Okay, but if we're talking about agents that create their own rewards in some way, how can we rule that out? What does that, you know, what are we talking about? So this is something that our lab has been thinking about and reading about for quite a while. And actually, the term intrinsic motivation goes back to Harlow, 1950. He studied rhesus monkeys being presented with puzzle boxes consisting of latches and hinges and so on. And he found that they were fascinated by manipulating these things and would work for hours and hours and hours without any reward, without any apparent extrinsic reward. And he, I think this is the first appearance of this term intrinsic motivation. And he hypothesized that there's a manipulation drive that's strong, persistent, that accounts for learning and maintenance of this puzzle performance. And further, he said that the drives of this class represent a form of motivation which may be as primary and as important as the homeostatic drives. Okay, so it's giving the status of a primary drive, or if there are rewards being generated for this as primary rewards. So that's one point that I wanted to make by that quote. Another person who's very did a lot of work with intrinsic motivation is Berlein, who in a book, 1960, one of the quotes is, until recently, rather little has been done to find out how animals behave when they're not doing anything, when there's nothing in particular to do. Our RL systems are always supposed to be doing something. You know, they're doing backgammon, or they're doing pole balancing, or they're doing, you know, what have you. But, you know, if you think of a organism or a robot that's a long-lived device, you know, I mean, organisms just don't stop. You know, they're always doing something. So what are they doing? Well, they're using intrinsic motivation to do exploration or whatever. So let's see. I think there's another Berlein quote from a science paper later. You can read this as well as I can. Let's see. Acknowledged accumulation conditions. Yeah, so that this behavior occurs very quickly after birth. So he says that it's unlikely that it's unlikely that it's learned. That's a primary drive for this type of behavior. So that it's not a result of a value function that's been learned through experience, but is given. And there's a lot of data to support this. All right, and there have been lots of computational studies of intrinsically motivated reinforcement learning systems. Notable is Jürgen Schmidhuber, who talks about curiosity. His idea was that the goal is to build a model of the world. Not clear what that really means, but where the error decreases in prediction error were acted as rewards. And so the agent would want to explore in certain ways to reduce these errors. And so there's a series of papers. Actually, Rich had this idea too. Before you never wrote this up. What was the name of that? You had some...
S4,
yeah.
Surprise.
You were before your time with that one. But Schmidhuber in the early 90s probably was the first to publish some related ideas. Maybe Rich doesn't think they're related, but I don't know. And Rich, so the exploration bonus could be considered a type of intrinsic reward, right? You keep track. So part of the state is the memory structure, this keeping track of how long it's been since these states have been visited. And Frederick Kaplan and Pierre Yves Houdet in France talk about similar systems where their reward is a measure of learning progress, again, based on prediction error. And there have been lots of people looking at this. And I think Jerry mentioned Catherine Merrick and Mary Lou Mahler yesterday with regard to the non-player characters that they've been working on. And so Tinder and me and undergrad, Chintenas did a paper in quite a while ago, but we departed from what most people were doing where they said this intrinsic reward was based on prediction error. We wanted to use it to learn reusable skills. So we didn't just want to learn a model, we wanted to learn how to do things and then to cache those away. And the idea is, so in the options framework where we'd use something like an intrinsic reward to say, here's something interesting, let's learn all about it and cache that knowledge away. So maybe later it'll be useful, maybe not, but it might be useful when a specific problem comes up. So there's quite a bit of work along these lines. And you know, none of it is really satisfactory in terms of formally saying what one should mean by it. What is the distinction between an intrinsic and an extrinsic? Is there any? And so on. So let's return to this less misleading view. So here's the misleading view of an RL agent. We put the critic in the environment. This is the source of the primary reward. What you really need to do is factor the environment into an internal and external environment, where we're now talking about internal to an organism or a robot. And so I'm just refining this. I'm not really changing the formalism. I'm just adding some more structure to it. The critic here generating primary reward is internal, right? So in this sense, all rewards are internal. Right, so intrinsic does not mean internal, because all rewards are internal, and so what might we mean by intrinsic reward? Well, it's not clear. An extrinsic reward in this, what we normally think of as extrinsic reward, would be, you know, something, some sensation that's very trivially transduced by the reward structures that would produce an internal reward, maybe. Extrinsic reward, and intrinsic reward must depend, well, I think we're still unclear, but you know, one idea was that it would depend on internal variables, but normal rewards depend on internal variables too. You know, if you're hungry, right, that's an internal signal, and that's going to influence the reward signal. So it's not quite clear. One thought coming from the developmental view and the literature on intrinsic motivation is that somehow intrinsic reward is problem independent. I put quotes around problem because a problem in the sense that reinforcement learning people think about, you know, this is where you have a reward signal and it's posing a problem. And the idea here is that maybe, you know, the reward signals that are independent of the specific problem. Of course, they pose problems in themselves, right, if there's actual reward signal. So it's a different type of problem somehow. So anyway, we're still trying to think about what really is a good mathematical formal characterization of this, if there is one. So it let us think about evolution and what happens in nature, and so and relationship between learning and evolution, because our motivational system is the result. It's a highly evolved structure, and so how does this work? So there's a bit of literature on the relationship between learning and memory. There was a book edited by Ballou and Mitchell on adaptive individuals in evolving populations. Another book on the Baldwin effect. Most of this work really does deal with the Baldwin effect, which is the influence of learning on evolution in a non-Lamarckian kind of way. It's not something that I want to focus on. I think some of the most interesting work, especially with regard to reinforcement learning and the relationship between learning and evolution, is done by David Ackley and Michael Littman. Is Michael still here? He doesn't even have these on his web page, unfortunately. I think this was done many years ago. But there's some interesting observations and papers. So learning and evolution. So again, just to sort of how we think about this. And I think, you know, we've always thought about this. There's a primary reward that's hardwired by evolution. Now, this is this motivational system. And it can depend on internal variables, external variables, other kinds of things, memory. Then inside the agent, if it's the kind of reinforcement learning system we think about, there's a learned reward based on the value function. Perhaps it's the gradient of the value function gives a secondary or learned reward, as in the actor-critic architecture, or for example. And the primary reward is a necessary component to nail down what that really means. It's the single number that Rich was talking about. But wrapped around this is the evolutionary process, and the real goal is reproductive success. And so the primary reward is there because it facilitates reproductive success. So there's another level, and to help us understand where these reward come from, it's useful to think about how they fit into this process. So there are lots of things that come from viewing things in terms of this more naturalistic, real-life kind of way. And this is a picture that courtesy Chris Vigorito, who's sitting, and George Conandaris, I think the words are due to, I don't know, who, but so you can't back up death. So there's certain things that we can't learn because we die, right? And so, you know, we don't start a new episode, right? Or if we do, we've had our weights zeroed out, right? So you can't back up. What font is that? That's a really interesting font. All right, so and in fact, this is, I was thinking about this and trying to think of a better rationale for showing it to you. But I think, you know, in biology, there's an asymmetry between the appetitive system and the aversive system. And in our models, we just say, well, we got pluses and minuses, and it's all one thing, right? And we've known this. I mean, you know, Peter especially has been hammering on how this computational theory differs from the real thing. But we've sort of said, well, why worry about that unless we can think of a good computational reason? And I think this is really a good reason. I mean, the aversive system, I mean, aversive stimuli generally cause the organisms to stop doing what they're doing. You know, not just a learning input, but actually influences directly behavior. And it's a safety net for avoiding this. And so it works differently than the appetitive system. And this is something to think about. Okay. So now I stumbled on a paper, and I don't remember where this came from. But Larry Samuelson and Jerome Swenkels in Theoretical Economics 1, a paper called Information Evolution and Utility. It's a frustrating paper. I've read it about 5 times, and I waver between thinking it's trivial and being profound. And I'm still not sure. But it's interesting anyway. And so their question is, given that successful descendants are the currency of evolutionary success, why do people have utility for anything else? Is the question that they're looking at. And this paper is full of... It's got a lot of interesting, thought-provoking things, but and I'm not going to go through very much of it, but they have this model where there's just one choice, accept or reject, and on accept, success occurs with probability P, failure with 1 minus P, and for reject, Q and 1 minus Q. And the utilities attached to these outcomes are X for success and Y for just deciding to accept, irrespective of the outcome. So just deciding to accept yields utility Y irrespective of the consequences. You know, so this is like, you know, steak tastes good. You know, just the very act of doing this yields some utility or reward. We could translate that for our purposes. And so they're interested in when you would want to ever make Y non-zero. And so the optimal rule in terms of success or failure is to accept if P is greater than Q, right? But the utility maximizing rule to accept if X plus Y plus PX is greater than QX. And if you, so when would you ever make Y non-zero? Why would you want to subsidize the decision itself to accept? Well, they argue the agent doesn't know P and Q, and so it has estimates. And so now the utility maximizing rule is in terms of these estimates. Or without loss of generality, set X equal to 1, then accept if Y plus P approximate is greater than Q approximate. And so the evolutionary optimal rule would be to accept if delta, the true delta, is greater than 0, and to accept the utility maximizing rule would be accept if Y plus the approximate difference was greater than 0. And they look at a lot of cases where it makes sense, they argue, to set Y non-zero. And it really hinges on, and it's not surprising, given that these are estimates, systematic errors in the agent's estimates of P and Q will cause evolution to attach utilities in order to correct for this. You know, so they put it in terms of weaknesses of the ability to have knowledge of what these true consequences are. And so this is interesting. I'm not going to explain this completely, but there are even cases where on average the agent actually overestimates the value of success, and yet it makes sense to add Y to it. And these are cases where there's limited information about the outcome. Actually, the example I think they give is blinking. That we don't have information about the consequences of blinking or not blinking, and so they say that evolution makes it obligatory to blink. We don't have a choice about it, and so that accept. So that action is subsidized very heavily by evolution. So anyway, this is just, I mention this because I think it touches on the kinds of issues that are involved in evolution and intrinsic reward. How much do I have? 5 minutes? I can talk as long as I want. Okay. So some computational experiments. So it's a Tinder. And Rick Lewis, who's a cognitive psychologist at University of Michigan, and I talked about this. And We actually put a paper together. Where do rewards come from? It's going to appear. It's at the Cognitive Science Conference in July. And has some computational experiments that I want to run by you, just some of them. I'm just going to talk about one of them. So this combines evolution and learning, although we don't do evolution. It's just a search in this reward function space. So we're not using any kind of genetic algorithm. But so the setup is this. There's an RL agent and a space of reward functions. These are primary reward functions. There's a set of MDPs and a distribution over that set. Given a reward function, R sub A, contained in this set, and a sample environment from this set of environments, from this set of MDPs, get a history. So you run the agent in that environment for a fixed length of time, running using some learning algorithm. And I think it's Q learning. And then there's a fitness function, F, that evaluates H to give H of F. I mean, F of H. So this is a surrogate for the evolutionary fitness of this agent using that reward function and learning with respect to it. And then when we talk about the optimal reward function, R star sub A in that set is the reward function that maximizes expected fitness over the distribution of environments. Okay, and so we're interested in what's R star. So computing fitness is done. So it's sampling N different MDPs, running Q learning, averaging these, actually searching over some parameter settings and choosing the best of those. So this is a computational detail important for making it work, but I think not so much for what I'm going to say here. Okay, there are several domains discussed, but my favorite, because it relates to intrinsic reward, I think, is this boxes domain. So it's a grid world with four quadrants, so those dark lines are barriers. The state, so there are two boxes, and the state really is the x and y coordinates of the agent, location, the status of the agent. This looks like a hungry agent, hungry or not hungry. Box one can be open or closed. Actually, there's another half open, but I'm glossing over that. Box two can be open and closed. And then food at the location of the agent, yes or no. And I was trying to think of something that people wouldn't be offended by if the agent devoured these food organisms. So the actions, the normal move north, south, east, and west, and then if the agent's at a box, actually sitting on the same location of box, it can choose to open it. And then if it's on a food, if there's food having not escaped from the box, it can choose to eat it. Otherwise, these actions don't do anything. Okay? So fixed across environments. So we know, or at least our intuition and some of Michael Littman and David Ackley's work talks about this as well, that if there are fixed things across these environments, the evolutionary process can tap into them and take it and put that into a primary reward function, whereas variable things, learning has to take care of, because evolution can't anticipate that sort of variability. So fixed across the environments, there are always two boxes, and they occur, well, there are two boxes, and the dynamics are such that a closed box always contains food, which escapes as soon as the box is open, unless the agent tries to eat it immediately. So it flies away. When the agent does consume food, it becomes not hungry for one time step, and that increments the fitness. So we're thinking of the cumulative number of steps that the agent was not hungry as a surrogate for the evolutionary success. An open box closes with probability 0.1 at every time step. So the boxes will close sometime after they open, and then there'll be food in them at that point that can be released the next time the agent opens them. So that's fixed. Changing is the location of the boxes. So the boxes can occur in any pair of corners. I don't know if they can occur together in the same corner. No. So So that varies. And so the evolutionary process can't provide rewards about going to a certain corner because it varies across these environments. Okay. The space of reward functions that we're searching over, all mappings from combinations of states of the boxes and the agent's hunger state to a discretization of the range -1 to +1. And there's 54,000 of these. And it's deliberately kept to be small, so we can do a essentially exhaustive search through this without worrying about any kind of fancy optimization scheme. Then there's three classes of reward functions. One is simple fitness-based. So you might think a really good primary reward function would be to reward the agent every time it its fitness increments. Every time it eats something, becomes not hungry, reward it. So that would be kind of the commonsensical, you know, +1 when you eat something and 0 otherwise. So that's simple fitness-based. Fitness-based, more generally, though, makes that same distinction between events that yield an increment in fitness and not, but doesn't assign 0 and 1. It assigns any two numbers. So this allows it to do, for example, a minus, a little penalty for the hungry states, which improves performance. And then unconstrained, where the other features can participate in the reward function. And then there's two experimental conditions. One is constant condition. Food appears in closed boxes throughout the agent's lifetime. And then the step condition, which is the one I'm going to focus on, is where each lifetime is 20,000 steps and the food only appears in the second half. Okay, so you can imagine, I think, pretty easily what's going to happen. And indeed it does. So this shows mean fitness growth for the constant environment. And we see that the best fitness-based, the best simple fitness, so this is rewarding it whenever it's not hungry, is very slow in accumulating fitness. If we allow more general but still fitness-based, performance much improved, but we can actually do better than that with another reward function. And then if we look at the step condition, so there's no possibility of accumulating fitness in the first half because there's no food whatsoever. And food appears here, and the best simple fitness-based reward is this, which presumably is putting a 1 on whenever it's not hungry. And then the best fitness-based one is this. And then you can do much better than this. And it's not surprising that why you can do much better is that the agent has a reward function that rewards it for playing with the boxes in the first half of its life. Right, so that is very much what we mean by an intrinsic type of reward. Actually, the actual best reward function, it's penalized when it's hungry with one box open and otherwise, but it's penalized less if a box is open. So this gives it an incentive to learn how to open boxes. Well, learn how to navigate to them and open them. So when food does arrive, it's immediately able to exploit that. So opening boxes is rewarding, comparatively at least, when the agent's hungry, which is the whole first period. It's hungry because there's no food at all. Okay, so and this shows the mean cumulative both boxes open curve. And you can see that that compared to the other reward functions, the best one really yields this much enhanced frequency of opening the box. So this is what does this mean? What does this mean? Sutinder can tell us what it means. It illustrates how tricky it can be to specify a good reward function because these are very sensitive These numbers that came up with, you change things a little bit, you know, it'll spend its life opening, you know, the same box and not eating, you know, or, well, you know, it will be persistent about a goal that isn't relevant to the fitness. And so there's you know, it's very sensitive to the even in this simple task, and in more complicated problems, I would imagine that compounds. I think it helps us understand what intrinsic rewards are. They're just like other primary rewards, but they're farther removed from the ultimate objective. In this case, the fitness. So there's nothing magical or different about them. I think of them as analogous to secondary or learned rewards, but at the evolutionary level. So they're things that are ubiquitously useful across environments, and rewards get wired in that motivate the agent to achieve certain things that turn out. Exploration, obviously, is a useful thing, and so on. So these, the tendency to play and manipulate and all these things are very useful from an evolutionary point of view, except they're not directly related to the homeostatic goals of maintaining blood sugar level and the normal kinds of things that people think of with regard to biologically relevant motivations. So, to me, I think that clarified some things about what we mean by intrinsic reward. It raises a lot of questions, which I'm sure you can... How much time have we got? Okay, all right. So, I think I'm pretty much done. You know, one question I think that comes up is, well, what if we had a better learning algorithm? And then another thing that comes up is, well, I mean, is there going to be a tendency to exploit internal variables in the reward functions? Because those are going to stay, their meaning, the semantics of them is going to stay relatively constant. So evolution can exploit those constancies. Comes up, why not do shaping rewards instead? Why twiddle with the primary reward? I think you can see in the two-stage process that a shaping reward would disappear in the first part because there's no reward. It would just extinguish. And so I don't think you can argue that shaping rewards can serve the same purpose as this careful design of a reward, of a primary reward function. So, my final slide. Not quite. Okay. So computational RL, as we talk about, is agnostic about where rewards come from, which is good, because it's an abstract theory, and I think, you know, its appeal is because it doesn't care. So it's can be applied and thought about over a wide variety of areas. But we know that specifying a good reward function is critical in applications, unless it's a relatively simple. I mean, backgammon is not simple, but the goal is relatively straightforward. And now you could probably do a fancy reward function that would make it perform better, but it would be very difficult to do that, I think. So it's important, and it can be very non-trivial in complicated domains. And in particular, the kind of domains I think about, you know, if you have a household robot that's supposed to satisfy the people who live in the house by doing different things at different times, and you know, how do you design? You know, what's the reward? Well, you need a motivational system. You need to have priorities and all sorts of things in order to do that. And we haven't really been studying that very much. And it's really outside of what we traditionally think of RL. And that's why I say beyond RL. So especially important in multifunctional domains like that one. And so I think it's necessary to look beyond RL at the problem of designing motivational systems. And that's that that purple thing, you know. And, you know, the other thing is that the RL systems we build now, if it has this, if it has a motivational system, then it doesn't need to work in arbitrary environments. It needs to work only in environments, one of whose component is this internal system, which we get to build and we know about. So it restricts the class of environments that the agent is facing. Of course, the external environment can be arbitrary, but the composite is going to be restricted among the class of all those composite environments. And that can be taken advantage of. Okay, I think I'm done. Essential help of a lot of people, of course, Satinder and Rick Lewis with regard to this last work. But a lot of us in the lab, present and some former students, have been thinking about intrinsic motivation, how we might think about this from a formal point of view so that it makes sense and can allow us to build agents that want to learn and do these things. So I want to thank these. I want to thank all my former students. Rich was the first, but I've had a remarkable string of students. And as I said, I think I've spent my career just trying to figure out the ideas they come up with, which has been, you know, and I'm sort of glad to hear Ben saying he still doesn't understand TD, because I don't either. So I think that's about it. And open for questions. Thanks.